はい。
I didn't bring the possible review sessions. Still trying to figure out the review session schedule, but there will definitely be one on Monday, May 8th in the afternoon. And I'm still open to having one on Friday, but it doesn't look at this point as if there's much interest in the times when I can do that. So let me again ask, how many of you would prefer or like a review session after class on Wednesday, the last class? Okay. A few? You know, rough estimate of numbers, 10 or 12? Thursday evening. A couple? Three, four? Thursday, late afternoon at 4 o'clock. 3, 4, 5. Friday afternoon. Saturday. Sunday. Afternoon. 10, 12. Okay. Sunday afternoon. Okay. I will see what I can do for rooms, and I'll announce the schedule. So don't lose that piece of paper. Okay. If you do find it. Okay. All right. Other questions? You're all okay. Good. We were talking about the interdependent stage of adolescence in the parenting lifespan. And I had suggested that because of puberty, the child is changed dramatically, and that affects the transactions with the parents. And the parents then spend all of adolescence coping with the changes that are being driven by puberty, and the intellectual development goes along with that. So in adolescence, the entire parenting, parent-child relationship gets readjusted. And some parents anticipate that with dread, others look forward to it. Some parents have difficulty making the adjustments and figuring out how to parent a person who is perhaps as large as they are, perhaps stronger, someone who is thinking with the same kind of logic that they use, and perhaps highly critical of the parent's reasoning, and able to question it at a level that may put parents very much on the defensive. So parents are trying to figure out how to adjust their parenting to accommodate the fact that they are no longer more powerful. They may hold the strings to the purse. They may have greater experience and wisdom. They may have more emotional maturity, but they do not have physical superiority, and they do not have intellectual superiority. So they have lost two of the major advantages that parents have up to early adolescence. So the parents are forced to be more equal, or forced to try to keep the child dependent and inferior And you can look at parenting strategies that might keep the child off balance and unequal. But those are typically destructive both to the adolescent and to the parent-child relationship. When you are trying to be in charge of someone who is your physical and intellectual near equal, you have to develop your negotiation skills. You have to take a new approach, a different approach, and gradually across the period of adolescence, what parents are trying to do is to help the adolescent assume more responsibility, and they're trying to give more power to the adolescent. They're trying to accommodate the power that the adolescent will be taking. They're trying to accommodate the greater reciprocity and maintain positive affect in the face of a transaction which for many people includes more negative affect as adolescents are able to become more powerful and more critical in their thinking. So adolescents often become disillusioned as they begin to discover their parents are even more flawed than they might have thought during childhood. And as they become more critical, they may become less respectful. And in challenging the parents' reasoning, in challenging the parents' strength and power and authority, the adolescent may put the parent on the defensive. And when people are placed on the defensive, one of our reactions is to get angry, to get anxious, to become negative. So there is more conflict in the adolescent-parent relationship as kids go into adolescence. Adolescents often seem as if they delight in creating that conflict and making their parents uncomfortable and unhappy. And I think they do. I think that's a legitimate interpretation, that parents are experiencing the adolescent testing their own power. And one of the ways you test your power is to make other people defensive, off balance, upset them. And you do that until you're certain that you really do have the power, and then you can make amends. Anna.
Is that kind of related to kind of the setup you were talking about of breaking up the different steps and what happened?
Okay. Anna is reminded of the steps in breaking up a relationship. Increased conflict, more disagreement as adolescents are practicing their intellectual skills and testing parental authorities. The disagreement leads to conflict, leads to negative affect, may lead to disrespect, and in fact is pushing parents and adolescents toward a breakup. And in some cases, they actually go that far. Excuse me. Inhale the air, swallow the water. Keep that straight and you'll live a long life. Yeah. Just keep breathing. There. Don't choke. So, in fact, there is a similar process of creating conflict and distance that's going on between adolescents and parents, as happens in a peer relationship as people begin to break up. So what do you do when that's happening in a relationship, when it gets to the point of breaking up? What you can see adolescents do, how many of you did that? How many of you slammed a door? How many of you told your parents you hated them? How many of you wished that you didn't have them as parents? You didn't want to be in the family. Okay, so.
You can't really feel like it's not you, it's me, your parents. You can't break up with your parents.
You can't break up with your parents. Aha. So what happens in a relationship where the conflict and disrespect are escalating and you can't break up? For whatever reason, you can't break up. What happens in those relationships? You throw up? You grow up. I heard you correctly. You may grow up, but what happens in peer relationships when there's a high level of negative affect, conflict, anger, disrespect? And you can't end them. For whatever reason, you can't end them because you can't imagine yourself being without the relationship. You're married and don't believe in separation and divorce. You're afraid to end it. What happens? That's an abusive relationship. That's when relationships become abusive. And that happens in parent-child relationships during adolescence when people know they can't leave. You know they can't throw the kid out of the house, although they do. They become abusive to each other. And it is not at all surprising that if a parent-child relationship has been characterized by abuse or abusive elements during childhood, when it gets to adolescence, the increased equality in power and the increased reciprocity and the ability to be abusive leads to open abuse and warfare in some families. So when you see kids who are attacking their parents, when you see adolescents and their parents who are engaging in fist fights, and hopefully that didn't happen to most of you, I'm sure it didn't, but it did to people that you went to school with. It did to people that you know. When that happens, it's interpretable, and it is part of the difficulty in dealing with the demands of adolescence on the part of the parent. The interdependence is creating conflict between equals, both of whom have strategies that are designed to hurt and abuse the other person. So if you look at the statistics, for example, on which children get killed by their parents, sometimes it's infants, sometimes it's young children, sometimes it's elementary school age children, though that's fairly rare. It does happen. There's a case in the paper recently of two elementary school children. It does happen. It's tragic when it happens, and it happens much more often during adolescence. Adolescents are much more likely to be killed by their parents than infants, toddlers, and children. And it's the entire interdependent stage gone totally off track. Infants never kill their parents. Toddlers never kill their parents. Elementary school children occasionally do, usually by accident and usually by firearm, when the parent is letting the kid play with a gun that he thinks isn't loaded and doesn't have a trigger lock, and famous last words of one dying father in Minnesota when I was in graduate school, "I didn't think it was loaded." Deal with that as a six-year-old, and you've shot and killed your father accidentally. That was an interesting one to deal with in the clinic. The number of adolescents who kill their parents is very high. Parents are among the most common targets for adolescents. Jim Garbarino, in his book Lost Boys, interviewed kids who kill, and over 100 of them. He also interviewed family members of the Columbine kids and several others. But in that book, he raises the question of whether adolescents who kill abusive parents are getting the short end of the stick. What happened socially is that we have made being an abusive spouse grounds for justifiable homicide. So if you're in an abusive relationship and your spouse is threatening to kill you or acting in ways that make you fear for your life and you kill first, Now, it didn't used to be, but now, that's justifiable homicide. It's self-defense. That rarely works for an adolescent who kills an abusive parent. The parents still have the upper hand, even if they're dead, in that situation. The kids who kill an abusive parent, particularly if that parent is attacking the other parent. So if you're a teenage boy, 15 years old, you have an abusive father who's attacking your mother and threatening to kill her, and you pull the trigger, you go to jail. It's not a defense to claim that you were acting in defense of your mother. And several of the boys that Garbarino interviewed who were serving terms of 40 years to life, some of them life without possibility of parole, had been in exactly that situation. Why?
Why? Protect them somehow. Or why do they get in trouble for pulling a trigger to protect their mom and they're in jail for a life?
Because we as a society have said that kids don't have the right to kill their parents, even in self-defense. Maybe we don't understand the situation the kids are in. But it hasn't worked yet. Jim's book has raised the question so that now we can talk about it and be aware that, maybe we ought to be thinking about this differently. Maybe we ought to be thinking about it differently. But at this point, the cynical answer to that question is that we still don't like adolescents in our culture. And so when they do something that we don't like, we get punitive. If the spouse kills the parent who is abusing a child, that's defensible. Okay. You're not supposed to do it, and we still frown, but it's defensible. So defending your children is okay. It means the parents have the right to act in homicidal ways in defense of their children. Children don't have the right to act in homicidal ways in defense of the other parent or themselves. I think if you watch the court dockets and the decisions over the next 10 or 15 years, you'll see that change. But it's striking that it has not been the case so far. Parents still have the status and the power, full citizenship, adolescents don't. Okay, boy, you got us off on that wonderful topic. The advice is deal with the interdependence of your burgeoning young adolescent in a way that won't get you killed. Because even if you're going to be defended by the society, which is going to throw the kid in jail if he kills you, you're still dead. And you probably don't want that. So parenting requires that you recognize that this relationship could lead to abuse and fistfights and death or injury. It could lead to an end, and the number of adolescents who leave their families of origin because of parental abuse is extremely high. You can end the relationship with your parents. Anybody who works at Spectrum downtown, anybody who works with homeless teenagers knows that teenagers often end the relationship with their parents. By some estimates, about 250,000 a year in the United States, adolescents end their relationship with their parents. And many of them never pick up that relationship again. Please? I'm sorry, between the difference between parental authority and abuse is when you cause harm. And then you get to define harm. When you hurt a child, you're not exercising your authority, you're abusing. It's defined differently in different cultures. Sweden says if you spank your two-year-old, that's abuse. It's illegal. We say you can do that. We advise people not to try to spank their 15-year-olds. And some of you have probably heard your mothers say, I can't spank you anymore. It's a sad day for mothers when they can't spank you anymore because they're afraid they'll get hit back and hurt. So the difference between authority and abuse is defined socially, but in our culture it's generally if you are causing harm to the child, if you're hurting development, or if you're causing physical injury or anguish beyond whatever the appropriate limit of anguish is, you're abusing the child. So we can end the relationship, we can make them very abusive, and you don't want to do that. So what you do in a reasonably healthy relationship when things start to fall apart and you're getting negative and lots of conflict and disrespectful is you go to therapy, right? Or you step back and say, wait a minute, this isn't the way I wanted this relationship to be. Huh, maybe I need to change the way I'm dealing with it. And then you go read Galinsky's book or you call your local professor of human development and family studies and say, help, I need to rethink my parenting. And you start going to workshops about being parents of adolescents and you change your approach. Generally in parenting, and this is a personal observation, because I've been there, done that, but it's also a very common observation, is that Galinsky has really nailed it by talking about the parents responding to developmental changes in the child and then having to accommodate those changes by changing what's going on in the parenting practice. And if you think about that, you have a child changing and a parent who's responding to the changes, and as in all families, in all systems, including family systems, the parent is going to resist that change. So parents are periodically playing catch-up. And during those periods of catch-up, things typically fall apart a little bit, because the child and the parent are out of sync with each other. So you go through a period of relative chaos or upset in the parent-child relationship, and then you adapt, you put it together in a different way. And some parents do that very quickly. Some parents are slow to change. Some parents recognize the need for change, but they don't have strategies for changing what they do. And the pubertal change is the biggest one. It's the hardest one to adapt to because it's the one that really presents you with somebody who is rapidly becoming a peer. And we don't think about parenting somebody who is practically an equal. In the last stage, the launching stage, you really get to confront that this person not only is an equal, but is becoming in many ways your superior, and you have to deal with that. As I said in the Developology text, I love to quote one of my mentors, Armin Grams, who used to teach this course, that our job as parents is to raise our children so that they can become equals and stand beside us. And then as he got older, he would add to that, and take care of us in the way we would like to be taken care of when we're old and senile and decrepit. And they will like us enough to actually take care of us. And if you think about your parenting long term, that would be a healthy way to keep it in perspective. You want to maintain that relationship. You want to create a relationship that is developmental and eventually between equals.
It's kind of like a role reversal, because they're being mm-hmm. parent and child, and then when they grow up, they're mm-hmm.
Anna's observation is that there's a kind of role reversal as you grow up, and as the power shifts from, I meant to write parent there, this is the power gradient, early on, the parents have the power. In adolescence, what you're coping with is that it's much more equal. And as you age, your adult child has the power, may have power of attorney, may be your guardian, may be in charge of whether or not you have your needs taken care of or not. As a personal example, some of you have heard this. I have durable power of attorney over my mother's health care decisions. She has asked me to do that. I am the person designated to decide when to pull the plug or whether to do any particular procedure if she's unable to make those decisions herself. And unable to make those decisions herself would mean any time she's unconscious, I get to decide. And she trusts me to do that. She's given me that power. I also have the legal responsibility for her finances. She can still take care of them, but everything is joint. We have a joint bank account. She manages it. I can write checks. I have the authority to talk to her healthcare providers, to Medicare, to Social Security, to anybody else with whom she has a business relationship, and to sign documents for her. That's a lot of power. It's a lot of responsibility. Some of you will have that. Some of you will have it relatively soon, either for grandparents or for parents. Many of you have parents who are dealing with that responsibility. And you hope that it's not really power that's being exercised, but responsibility. One of the difficulties some of your parents have, especially those with younger siblings still at home, is that you have parents here who have both adolescents and dependent parents and responsibility for both. They're in the sandwich generation. They're the chopped liver between the two slices of bread. Interesting question. Do people who are in the sandwich generation who have responsibility for taking care of, say, grandparents or elders, do they do their parenting during the interdependent and launching years differently? What do you think? How does it change them?
Well, maybe they're focusing on parents' responsibility for their parents a little more and not giving enough attention to the balance of power aspect between them. Maybe they're not giving enough attention to the adolescent in general.
Okay, so one of the possibilities, and this is the one that gets written about, is that the caretaking responsibilities of parents in the sandwich generation becomes an overwhelming burden. And therefore, their adolescents, they're less likely to be able to adapt to the interdependence of the adolescents. So they may not have time for the adolescents. But that's not what you were thinking.
I think it's almost like forcing parents to balance
things out. Okay, so you're thinking of it as the balancing better. So one of the options is that parents make more of an effort because they're aware of the burden. The parent in that situation is clearly responding to a complex mesosystem and a set of relationships. The responsibility may be great on the parents. Financial drain may be great on the parents. That can strain the parental relationship. As parents are spending their time with teenagers and aged parents, what they give up is the relationship with each other, just may not have time for it. Or in their own stress, the marital relationship may suffer because they're both dealing with too much. Sometimes career demands are in conflict. And from an ecological perspective, then, what you can do in looking at their situation is to see where the points of conflict are likely to be and what the competing burdens are, what the incompatible roles and expectations may be in the mesosystem. You have a parent who forgets that you were there yesterday and is complaining to the nursing home staff that you haven't visited in weeks, when in fact you've been there every day for a couple of hours and you're not getting any appreciation, and your parent is telling strangers that her children don't love her because they never come to visit because her short-term memory is gone and she doesn't remember that you really were there. All she's responding to is your absence. So you may be getting no appreciation, you may be getting stress in one of those mesosystems, you may be getting stress in another mesosystem for all of the adolescent developmental reasons, and then you may be getting flack in your marriage. So you can see that the ecosystem is providing potential for a lot of stress and conflict. Then, and this is the fun part about applying a developmental view, now you understand the situation, to say it will have a particular effect on a particular family is fortunately not really possible, because that depends on what kinds of view of the ecosystem the individuals have and what kind of skills they have for dealing with the variety of relationships and roles and expectations that they have. Are they skilled enough in the activities to balance? Do they have enough responsibility in the work setting to cut back, so that they can take care of elderly parents and be present for adolescents? What you see then is that people in this situation may respond in quite different ways, and then the consequences may be quite positive, they may be quite negative. They may favor the adolescents and ignore or neglect the elders. They may save the relationship with their parents and sacrifice the marriage. The kids may respond by jumping in and helping with grandma, or the kids may decide to skip school, do drugs, drop out, get pregnant, whatever they do when they're feeling neglected. So the developmental approach won't tell you specifically what a family will do, but it'll tell you what they're dealing with. Before all the blood drains out of your arm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so you've got parents dealing with your grandparent with Alzheimer's. They recognize that they're under stress. They have the wits to say, we need help. So now, play therapist. What are you going to do? Tell them to put grandma out to pasture? Tell them to separate for 3 or 4 years, after grandma dies, they can renew their marriage. Put the kids in foster care. What the developmental view lets you do is to assess what is going on in that family, and instead of focusing on some communication issue within the couple relationship, you spend time defining the ecosystem that they're suffering in and why. And then you can approach the various pieces of it. What could you do to get respite help? How long is this likely to last with grandma? How can you help your kids take a more active role? You're trying to do everything as parents. Your daughter's coming home for the summer. What could she do? I won't tell. What could she do in the household? What could she do with grandma? What could she do to help us? If our daughter comes home for the summer, could we sneak away for a honeymoon weekend? Would our daughter be capable of taking care of the household and grandma long enough? Okay. So your analysis of the situation allows you to start focusing on various ways to affect change in different parts of the ecosystem and to recruit your relationships, change your roles, look at the microsystem patterns in the various mesosystem settings you're in, and figure out how to get everything done that needs to be done. What are the new skills? What are the new expectations? How can you support each other? And for married couples in that kind of situation, you think to Gottman, maybe all they really need is a reminder every day to each other that they are really dealing very well with a completely out of control situation. And that may be enough for them to say, I love you, and this is great, and we're supporting each other, and this too shall pass. We'll get through this. And having gotten through it and done the best job we can, maintaining our relationships with each other and with our families and doing our responsibilities, maybe it's okay if we don't make as much money. Maybe it's okay if we don't do the expected extracurricular activities. Maybe it's okay if the house doesn't get clean this week. We understand the situation and we appreciate our relationship being in the middle of that. That may be enough therapeutically, changing the affect so that the marriage is no longer under stress. So people give each other more slack. They change the role expectations. They redefine the situation that they're in. But having a developmental view gives you the tools to do the analysis to figure out what you might do. And a little bit of change in the system may be enough. You may not have to shoot grandma, although you might be tempted. It's important to acknowledge the negative affect that comes up too. You may not have to throw your kids out of the house or say, please don't come home this summer. We can't deal with you. You might be, please come home, and we hope you'll be able to take a little responsibility that you're not used to, and we'd love for you to do that, and we'll reward you for that, and those sorts of things. Was there a hand? No. Okay. Thank you for that illustration, because it lets you see how you use this approach therapeutically. And a good therapist will understand that at some level. And if you understand it, you have the skills to analyze it as you're going into it. As you watch people in your family change, as you experience conflict, all of us try to understand the conflict. And if you have a developmental view, you don't have to blame the other person for the conflict that you're experiencing. You can say, oh, okay, we're in this really stressful situation right now. Let's make sure we handle it in as mature and responsible a way as we can. Let's talk about it, and let's think and rethink our roles and our responsibilities and our expectations. And in a few years, you'll be there and you'll say, let's see, what did Uncle Larry say? Let's go get that developmentalology book out. Okay, let me go back to the interdependent stage and look at some of the specifics, particularly in the challenges to authority. One of the issues there is that adolescents have a much larger mesosystem than children, and the mesosystem settings that adolescents get into often do not include the parents. And that's a big hassle. When the parents are not part of a transcontextual dyad, when they don't have intersetting knowledge, when they don't have primary relationships with the people that you're involved with in other settings, all of that is part of your becoming more autonomous. Your ecosystem is changing, and it overlaps less with the parents' ecosystem. And so your mesosystems are more distinct. And parents want that to happen, but they also have difficulty sometimes coping with it. So the closed activity network that you may be in with your parents as a child takes up fewer of your settings, includes, incorporates fewer of your settings as the number of settings increases and your parents aren't part of them. There may be less adult involvement generally in many of those settings. So parents have less control. They have less communication possibilities with those settings. You're getting into problems that your parents understand less well as an adolescent. You have parents who met each other when they were 15, the only person they ever dated. There they are, they got married, they're still married, they're happily married, they're wonderfully married, and you're having trouble with a boyfriend. They don't understand. They've never been there. So their advice may be out of a textbook, which is okay if it's the right textbook. It may be off television, or it may be just a, we've never been there, we don't get it. Or some of us who grew up without drugs. And there are some of us, not just in my generation, but in your parents' generation, who had no problem with drugs other than alcohol, because there weren't any. They just weren't there. Growing up for me, drugs were no problem at all. You went to the drugstore, you bought what you needed. I was in college before I figured out that my uncle who ran the service station, gas station, in a little town in Illinois, I was curious as a child why there were bushes hanging from the rafters in the service area. I didn't understand that until at some point. I knew about marijuana because the state police came and burned it off fields. But it was very, very low grade. It was actually marijuana left over from the hemp growing agribusiness in the Midwest. It used to make rope out of it. Still make rope out of it in many parts of the world. And my understanding is that some people smoked it, but it wasn't very potent. So anyway, my uncle, my father's brother, had those plants. And after I figured out, when I was somewhere in my 20s, what had been going on, I asked him point blank. He was one of the world's early hippies. He was also an alcoholic. I asked him about the pot hanging in the service area. And he chuckled and, yeah. Don't do that anymore. Sold the gas station. Uncle Pete, the state police used to fill their cruisers at your station. Yeah? They didn't care. Yeah. Uncle Pete, did you smoke that? All of it? A lot of it. Uncle Pete, did Dad smoke? Uncle Pete said, you'll have to ask him. This was a year after my father died. I don't know. But I didn't have to deal with it in adolescence because it really wasn't there. And I've checked with high school classmates who said, nobody smoked. Some of them did later, when they went off to places where they were exposed to it as part of a culture, like places like the Air Force. Yeah, all over the world, smoking pot. And then we had kids. And we had kids and we had to deal with marijuana. We had kids and had to deal with other stuff of all kinds. And we didn't know what to do about it. It was illegal. We didn't know what to do. Your parents may have been in the same situation. So where do they learn to deal with you in a drug-heavy culture when they haven't had it? Okay? So there may be problems that parents haven't had and don't understand, so guiding adolescents may be difficult. The other end of that is that often adolescents are involved in problems that the parents share. So you got a drinking problem in adolescence, and your parent has a drinking problem, who do you go to for assistance with that? How does the parent guide the adolescent who is now not only equal but can drink the parent under the table? And do you allow that to happen, or do you say alcohol is bad for you, you can't drink until you're 21, while the parent is holding a whiskey and soda, having that conversation with you? There's a little hypocrisy there. And hypocrisy is relatively common among parents of adolescents. The two major issues that Galinsky describes are communication, keeping it open, and setting limits, giving appropriate guidance. How do you set limits on the communication if you're having the same problem the kid has? My classic example is the divorced parent who's dating, who has an adolescent who's dating, and so they're talking about their relationships. And mom has her boyfriend overnight, and daughter wants to have her boyfriend overnight, and mom says no. Excuse me? How does the parent give guidance and set limits? What are the limits for behavior that would be the same for people who are in somewhat the same situation? How do you set a limit that the parent can be comfortable with and enforce without seeming to be really hypocritical? And some of you have been in this situation. I've read your descriptions of it, and I've heard your complaints about parents who are much less mature than you are in their relationships as they're dating. And it's embarrassing at times for some of you because your parents behave much less well than you do in relationships. We've already talked a little bit about intersetting knowledge, the problem of not having transcontextual dyads, having kids involved in activities that the parents aren't involved in. And I'm very impressed and sometimes very distressed by the comments that I hear from parents when I do parents groups about adolescents. One of the common complaints is that they think they can't set limits. They're frustrated by their inability to set limits. And they're often frustrated because their values are not shared by other parents. So a parent will be a member of a group talking about what they're going to do as their kids become adolescents. They don't want their kids to drink or do drugs. There's often a sense of futility on the part of the parents as they say, well, we can keep it from happening at our house, but we can't keep it happening other places. We know it's going to happen. So what can we do about it? So they're caving, basically. They're saying, we can't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. As that there were a lot of things that didn't get pushed to a certain point because we were still there.
Right.
So they tried to be as lenient as possible, and that's sort of.
So they weren't the ones who bought the pot for the party.
They had nothing to do with that. Yeah.
And they weren't the ones who provided the keg for the party when you were 16. Some of you had parents who provided the pot, who provided the keg, who permitted the booze, who knew you were going to have a party, and left. They completely abdicated their parental responsibility, and you respect them very much for that. Right? They weren't doing the rest of us any favor. But that's what happens when parents don't know how to deal with the problem and feel that they're unsupported in the community and everybody else does it, so why don't they do it? And then they leave that one set of parents or two set of parents in the community feeling incredibly unsupported because they, in fact, are not going to let their kids go to that party. And their kids feel left out. And what's interesting is that, to me, when I'm leading those groups, is I challenge the futility of it, and I suggest to them that if there are 20 families represented in a group, and their kids all go to the same school, because usually school-based workshops, if there are 20 families, and they all agree on what they want, then maybe they should commit to each other on a set of values that they're all going to present to their children and a set of limits that they're going to set and spread through the community. They're in charge of the little piece of the macro system in their community. What I'm hearing from the parents, the way to interpret this developmentally, is that the parents know what's going to happen in other homes. They know what happens. And they feel they're in the minority. And they're not communicating across the various cultures or families in the community. So what they're allowing to happen is a consistency across settings. Definition of macro system. Consistency across settings in the community, which is going to allow illegal behavior engaged in by people who aren't prepared to deal with it, in settings where there are no adults present to create a microsystem that might keep it under control. And some households are going to feel frustrated and in the minority, and their kids are not going to participate because there are, in most communities, one or two families who have enough backbone to tell their kids, if any alcohol is served at that party, you are to call me, and I will come and get you. You may not stay there. It is illegal, and you may drink at home, at dinner, half a glass of wine under my supervision, but you will not drink in somebody else's house. Period. So you've got a family that will do that, and their kids feel that. They feel like a minority. They are in the community. But if you work with the entire group of parents, you can create a set of expectations that they'll reinforce to get them to commit to each other. I don't want my kid drinking in your house. Well, I don't want my kid drinking in your house. Good. I won't serve alcohol to teenagers. You don't serve alcohol to teenagers. And we'll get things under control. In the same way that parents can agree. Many of you had an agreement with your parents, right? You signed the form. You do not ever get in the car with somebody who's drinking behind the wheel. Period. I don't care what time it is, you call. I will come and get you. You will not be punished. I will bring you home. But if I ever catch you in a car with somebody who's been driving, you will lose all of your privileges for the rest of eternity. How many of you had that agreement with your parents that you could call them, you would not get behind the wheel of a car with somebody, and get in a car with somebody driving? Macro system. General agreement. Okay. So one of the difficulties that parents have in dealing with teenagers and those problems that parents don't know how to deal with is lack of discussion. And the issue in the macro system is that parents don't talk to each other about what they expect and how they're going to raise their kids. And that goes back to the discussion we had earlier. Special issues. It is a wonderful joke of nature that in our culture, adolescence coincides with menopause and midlife. So you have two generations trying to figure out what life is about, having a transaction between them, and the parents are saying, I'm frustrated in my job, I haven't gone as far as I would like, my marriage is stale, my kids are frustrating me, I hate the climate, I have depression, I've got a pot belly I can't get rid of, I'm out of shape, my heart's going occasionally, and I have angina. So what's life all about? and this kid who's questioning all of your views about life and trying to figure out what life is all about. And there they are in a transaction with each other. It's a wonderful joke. Larry Steinberg, if you want a book to give your parents, if you still have little sisters and brothers at home, Steinberg has a nice book, A Crossing Paths. And what he did was interview adolescents and their parents, several hundred of them, about the transactions that were going on for them. And he documents quite nicely the fact that just as kids start questioning their parents' values, parents are questioning their own values. And so parents are placed in a position of trying to guide kids at the time when their parents are trying to figure out what they believe. And that's in part a response to the adolescents pushing them to figure out what they believe. But it's also normative in midlife that you sit down and figure out where your life is going. And there you are watching yourself sag and get baggy and become less attractive. And there's your daughter. And she's the hottest thing on wheels. And you watch, you know, I remember watching my daughter walk down the street and watch guys go, and you know, wait a minute, that's my daughter. But also you realize she was going to be in places where, because she was a pubescent or early adolescent girl, and her mother and I had the conversations about how difficult it was to watch kids become everything that the society thinks you ought to be in a youth-oriented culture, and they're beautiful and they're handsome and they're strong and they're smooth and they look good in bikinis at about the time the parents were happy in muumuus. And we know we're not attractive anymore. So you want to throw the kids out of the house. Get rid of them. Dealing with the kids' sexuality. While you're still trying to feel good about your own. And then the kid starts bringing a new kind of peer home. And there you are. Your 15-year-old has invited her boyfriend home to evaluate you, home for dinner. And there you are. And parents are providing guidance. How do you respond to the boyfriend? You think he's a jerk. You think he's immature, he's not too bright, he's unmotivated, he probably drinks too much, he does all the drugs that you don't want your daughter to be exposed to, and he's a lousy driver, and you're supposed to be nice to him over dinner? Yeah. This is a problem. Parents have to figure out how to be interested in the peers, guide their child, not try to run their lives, accept the fact that you're kid may in fact be in a romantic relationship, and how do you deal with that? And how do you incorporate those new partners into the microsystem of the household? And what are the limits? How long can they stay around? How often can they be there? Some of us, you want the boyfriends and girlfriends in your house all the time while you're there, so you can monitor it. And you don't want your kids to spend time with their boyfriends or girlfriends in somebody else's house with parents you may not know. So you probably all have funny stories to tell about boyfriends and girlfriends and your parents. I will pass along one of my favorite fathers. Had three daughters, all attractive, all dating, all adolescent, about 2 years apart. And he said, it's real easy. When he found out I had a daughter younger than his, he said, it's real easy to be a parent. Real easy, especially with daughters. You make sure that you're home when he picks her up. He comes to pick her up. The first time, you've met him. Just you're meeting him. He comes in the door. He says, great, hi. She'll be down pretty soon. You know she's going to be late, so that's okay. You know you've got about 10 minutes. So you say, want a beer? And the kid, the 16-year-old, says, Sure. Yeah. Okay. So he takes it. It's okay because he's not going to drink it. Because you're there. He's going to hold it. He's not going to drink it. That's okay. So then you... So, how do you like school? I hated it. That's what you're telling. I never got along in school. School was boring. You know, really had no relationship to real life and the things I was interested. So now the kid's sitting there with your beer in his hand and he knows that you don't like school. So now he's, okay, this is cool. And you say, where are you going tonight? He tells you. How late do you expect to be out? And he says, well, usually we like our daughter to be home by 11, but it's Saturday night, and you know, so probably 11:30 is okay. But if you're out and you're having a good time, we'd rather that she came in later than have you drive too fast. You know, so don't sweat it. You know, it's okay. You know, we'll be asleep. Just make sure you get her home safely. So by now the kid has figured this is okay. He's, you know, probably going to sleep with her on the first date. And then you time it, he said, just before she comes down. She's just about at the top of the stairs. You say, and there's one more thing. So, no, just want you to know, my daughter is the most precious, valuable thing in my entire life. And if you ever make her unhappy or harm a hair on her head, I will rearrange your face. Seems to me like it would work, right? That was his advice. All three of his daughters are happily married. Two of them have children. It helped that he was a former boxer. And he was ugly. He was mean looking. He had a sign. They had a summer house, and it was in the woods, and he had a sign on the door with his picture on it, which said, you're welcome to come in if you're in trouble. You're welcome to use the facilities if you need them. You know, because it was a place where people could get caught in snowstorms or rainstorms. And from, you know. So he said, but if you damage anything or steal anything, I will find you and I will rearrange your face.
I was going to say, I saw a commercial the other day for Hogan Knows Best. And like, he's really protective of his daughter, and like, it shows how she had brings the boyfriend home. He's talking to him and like, he's grilling the kid. He's like, oh, let me show you something. And he goes like he has a shooting range from the area. He lets loose a machine gun. And he's like, if you do anything to my daughter, you just like, this is who I'm going to use on you, or something like that.
Yeah.
And it was like the most intimidating thing. Imagine like dating Hogan's daughter.
Well, that's similar. My friend didn't threaten with guns, but he didn't need them.
With his daughter's boyfriend?
No. Okay. So we get him through adolescence. And now they're headed out. How do you let go? How do you support while you're letting go? How do you negotiate being financially depended on as a parent while your child is making his or her own decisions about where to go, where to live, who to date, how to be, what to major in, all of the, where to spend spring vacation, and you've got the responsibility for the credit card that your kid is using. So it's the departure stage that tests the parents' confidence in what they've taught. And for some parents, that departure stage doesn't go very well. They discover, for example, that there were things they didn't teach. When the kid maxes out the credit card first semester, when the kid gets asked to leave UVM because he or she can't control his or her drinking behavior or other behavior, when the kid comes home and says, I'm on probation academically. Well, I think I picked the wrong school, and you as a parent have helped. You've spent days helping the kid pick the right school and visited all these schools, and the kid is absolutely certain. and you had doubts about the choice the kid made, and the kid comes home and says, I'm plunking out, I picked the wrong place, I want to transfer. How do you say, oh, okay, well, let's talk about that. What's the process of transferring? And how do you do that without saying, I told you so? How do you deal with supporting the kid's decisions, advising when asked, and trusting that the kid will learn from his or her own experiences, and those experiences will gradually involve the parents less and less? Parents have difficulty with that stage when they think they know what you ought to be studying and what your schedule ought to be and where you ought to be living. Parents have trouble with that stage when you do need their financial help, but they want to make the decisions for you because they're providing the financial help and you don't want them to. You want the help, but not the decisions made for you. So there's struggle around that. This one hit me particularly hard. Another personal example, that same cute blonde girl decided after high school, she graduated from high school a year early, and the deal was in doing that, that she couldn't go to college. She wasn't old enough to go to college, but she had to do something else that was educational. So she joined the Army. She was recruited for the Old Guard, Fife and Drum Corps. She was accepted, and then she also got accepted to do a year in Australia, so she picked that and resigned from the Army before she reported and made them mad, made me happy. Yeah. Well, boot camp would have been good for her. And the Old Guard would have, she would have traveled all over the world. But she went to Australia, and as I put her on the plane to go to Australia, and I was not going to go visit during the year because I couldn't afford it, and our son was still at home. I was aware that she was heading off at 16 to the other side of the world where she was going to live with a family that I did not know. She was going to go to a school that I knew nothing about and couldn't be an involved parent in. And that this was before email. So that's how old I am. No email. So communication was going to be sporadic at best. And as a parent, I was faced with the reality that I encouraged this and wanted her to have the adventure, but I no longer had any direct control over what happened. And she was going to have significant relationships and molar activities and adventures with people that I would not know. In other words, she was going to have a life that I didn't share. And as an involved parent, very much committed to knowing what my kids are doing and sharing their lives with them, I'd be crying a lot. And that's what happened. She had all these wonderful adventures with all these wonderful people, and I've never met them. And you have to deal with that. Your parents are dealing with that. And in the process, they're evaluating themselves as parents as they watch you go out and make an idiot of yourself or convince the world that they didn't teach you anything that they should have taught you. Or they get to watch you and your successes and your wonderful adventures and wish that they could go back and be your age again. So there's a little envy there for some of your parents. Some kids leave early. As I said, my daughter was 16 and she never really was home again after that. I wasn't ready for that. Some people leave late. And in our culture, it's not common for kids to live at home until they get married. It is common in many other cultures. You're expected to live at home with your parents until you marry and establish your own household. But that's not common in our culture. What do parents do after you've graduated from high school and you decide not to go to college and then you quit your job and there you are at home living in the basement, walk out. You know, like, there you are living in the basement, listening to music they don't like, and smoking things they don't smoke, and drinking, and hanging out with your friends until 4 o'clock in the morning, and sleeping till noon, and you're 20 years old. This is a departure problem. They want you out of there. Again, one of my friends is a case. He has a kid who has some fairly significant learning disabilities, but he also has an alcohol and drug problem, and his parents have enabled him for many, many years. And the triumph 2 years ago was that at 27, he got a job. 27. He got a job. And then he got his own apartment. He's been living in the basement, smoking pot, smoking, drinking, getting in trouble with the law, all of those things for years. And his parents had been sort of spinning their wheels, refusing to get the kind of help that most of us have been suggesting for them. But the parents are just thrilled now that he's actually out of the house. Then you have to deal with the empty nest. And then you realize the launching that you were engaged in getting your kids out was the shuttle. It goes up, goes into orbit, goes around 3 times, loses its job, and comes home. That is much more common. 10 or 15 years ago, the assumption was kids left, they went to college, they got a job, they never came home again. The exceptions were people who went into the military and came home briefly when they were discharged, or people who got divorced, particularly daughters, and had kids and came home temporarily because they needed the support of the extended family. Now it is much more common that college graduates go home and stay home, or leave and come back and leave and come back. And that's a function of the macro system. It's a function of the economy. And it's a problem for many parents trying to figure out how to have that shuttle come home and treat you, and some of you will do it, to treat you as an adult, give you your autonomy and your adulthood, not be responsible for you, but have an adult relationship with you while they're trying to respect you while you are underemployed. Other issues that Galinsky describes are the wild oats and the late bloomers, the difficulties of dealing with in-law children, because departure often means getting married and then incorporating the in-law children. So how do you do that when your kids are between jobs or between cities and they come home to live with you and you now have to incorporate this married couple into your household, which was a comfortable empty nest, and now your privacy is being invaded. And then grandchildren and then divorces. All of those get involved. Let me leave you a question for Monday and encourage you to read the article by Margaret Renkel on the reserve list, oldest, youngest, or in between. We'll talk about sibling order and family constellation. Have a good... Is today Wednesday? Yes, have a good weekend.